possible with support from Verde Gallery, featuring indelible impressions, paintings by Charu Khan, and ceramics by Rimas Vizcarda. Verde carries a wide selection of handmade items suitable for the holidays. Verde Gallery, a fine art gallery, cafe, and newsroom at 17 East Taylor, downtown Champaign. On the web at verdant-systems.com. Be inspired.
An excerpt from a medley of Marx Brothers films, the medley introduced an elderly Groucho to an adoring audience at Carnegie Hall in the early 1970s. Marvin Hamlisch was at the piano. Groucho was a huge star, of course, but at the beginning it seemed he and his brothers, despite their mother's drive and desire, would never make it. More about that later. This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in. The Marx Brothers, one of the greatest American comedy teams. On the program today, we take a look at the wit and wisdom of America's great teams. Our guest is Lawrence Epstein. He is a professor of English at Suffolk Community College. He's the author of two books on comedy. His latest is Mixed Nuts, America's Love Affair with Comedy Teams from Burns and Allen to Belushi and Aykroyd. Epstein says in the introduction to this book that when he began writing, he quickly realized that the story of comedy teams in America was much more than simply the story of some very funny people. There was, it turned out, he said, a deeper social history of American life embedded in their story. He said, quote, "I noticed that they had met the deepest emotional needs of American audiences and helped shape our inner lives." Listeners, this afternoon I invite your questions and comments for our guest, Lawrence Epstein. Which comedy teams have been your favorites over the years? Join the discussion with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Outside the local dialing area, if it would be a long-distance call, use the toll-free number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. In addition to Mixed Nuts, America's Love Affair with Comedy Teams from Burns and Allen to Belushi and Aykroyd, our guest, Lawrence Epstein, is the author of The Haunted Smile, the story of Jewish comedians in America. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Lawrence Epstein, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you for inviting me.
Sure, my pleasure. You know, reading your book led me back to my old comedy albums, and I wanted to share something with you and with the audience this afternoon from one of them, because it dovetails so nicely with your thoughts about how comedy reflects the tenor of our times. And this is from the back of the album Cheech and Chong. Here we are in the 70s. Vietnam, racial unrest, disagreeable dope laws, the release of the Pentagon Black Diaries, etc. So in light of the current funny world situation we live in, and with our distinct longing for laughter in the face of disaster, may we offer you the hard rock comedy of one Chicano, Cheech, and one Chinese, Chong, in hopes that laughing with tears in the eyes does not become the national pastime. It says a lot, doesn't it?
It certainly does. You know, I started the book with a memory of my own childhood. I had been given a shot in the arm by the doctor. I came home and I couldn't lift my arm, and I was really afraid. So I dragged myself in front of the TV, and there come the flickering images of Abbott and Costello. I started laughing. The pain went away. I forgave the doctor for inflicting this pain on me. And I, as an adult, I realized those are the great gifts, and Cheech and Chong have repeated them. As adults, we're aware of what's going on in the wider world, but even in our own personal lives, the comedy is there to take us out of the moment of agony, and at least for a few minutes, give us relief, and maybe, I think at its height, give us a perspective so that when we go back to the real world, we're better able to deal with those problems.
Yeah, yeah. Have comedy teams been aware, or perhaps acutely aware, of the emotional needs of their audiences era to era?
In a way, I would put it that they were great psychologists in the sense that they listened to the audience. You know, when George Burns and Gracie Allen went out, Burns would go out on stage beforehand and he'd blow a cigar, see which way the smoke was going, because he knew if the smoke went in Gracie's face, the audience would never forgive him. When they started, George was supposed to be the funny person and Gracie give the straight lines, but he listened to the audience, and the audience told him, no, you've got to reverse it. So the comedians who succeed over time are the ones with a remarkable sense of what an audience wants. I don't think they sit down and say, now, what's going on in the culture? How is this? They do it not in an academic sense, but in a very practical sense of being very astute, very sensitive to the portrayal of the audience. In a way, it sounds odd, but the audience's applause and laughter help shape the comedian's character and lines. If you listen carefully, you know what gets the response. And that's what the great comedians did. Tommy Smothers told me that their signature line, Mom Always Liked You Best, came in with an improvisation, and the audience laughed, so they used it the next show and the next show. And I think a lot of teams, a lot of comedians for that matter, just are such astute listeners, so sensitive that they get it.
Yeah. Well, George Burns knew that the audiences, they liked Gracie, so that led him to define her role in their performances.
That's right. Gracie was beloved by the audience. You know, she had a tough life. She had been burned as an infant. You'll never see a picture of Gracie Allen in short sleeves. She was embarrassed by the sight of the burned arm. She was imprisoned, in a way, by the character she created. It was a wonderful character, a hilarious character, but she always had to keep it up. Audiences did not want her, even in so-called real life, to drop out of that persona. And so she developed migraines. It was painful for her to be in show business. She always wanted to leave. But how do you leave it? You're so successful. You're so beloved. Mm-hmm. Yet she wanted to do. There is a pain to fame in her case.
Yeah. That voice that we know as Gracie, that's not her real voice. It wasn't her real voice. What did she sound like?
It was deep. It was a much more pleasant, much more ordinary voice, but it wasn't funny. Hmm. And she was trying, you know, comedians starting in vaudeville when Burns and Allen began had to do anything. Burns would roll up his pants and wear a funny tie. And Gracie had it. What could you do to distinguish yourself? You had to have a gimmick. And Gracie's gimmick was that high-pitched voice, which seemed to fit in with the character she created. You know, all these characters the comedians develop are very carefully constructed, and they played around. So she didn't have that voice the first time she went out on stage. It probably happened just by accident, and then there was the reaction. It's art, because we see the end result. We see the success. But the slow development over time is, in a way, more interesting.
Yeah. Talk with us, if you would, about George Burns and his idea of illogical logic, which gave Gracie, you know, that was the outline for Gracie.
Sure, absolutely. George Burns had been a complete failure. He'd been born on the Lower East Side. His dad had died early. He began at age 5 in a singing group. He said the only place they found success was the Staten Island Ferry, because to escape them, the audience had to jump overboard. So they at least had an audience that stuck around. Burns was a failure at school. He lost a long battle with arithmetic and dropped out early. He would do anything to get a job. So he would say, if there was an ad in the paper, wanted someone with a trained seal, well, Burns would call up and say, unbelievably, that's my area of expertise, although he had never seen a seal in his life. He did this for years and years and years. Finally, Gracie came along, and he really got the idea of what he called illogical logic from his mom. His mother would make these statements, and they made perfect sense on their own, but they sounded funny. And Burns did not like the typical woman comedians of the time. They were called Dumb Doors, and as the name implies, they came out and they were very stupid. Burns thought that was not what a real woman was like. Real women were interesting and important, as his mother was. And so when he found Gracie, when they were developing the characters, he couldn't get too far in front of the audience. So he took the Dumb Dora idea, but modify it. So Gracie is not dumb at all. She's very smart on her own terms. She's very dignified. And he listens to her. So it was an interesting structure and characterization.
Yeah, and that way, both men and women like Gracie.
Exactly right. Gracie was widely admired by women precisely because she was not dumb. In a way, I see it as sort of a sly satire on how men viewed women's minds. I think Gracie was very clever. Over time, it was more difficult to sustain that, and because she stayed young. And then, but once they found that they could get into George and Gracie as a married couple, that was a whole new area, a whole new world of satire to enter. And Gracie found that voice again.
Yeah, it's very interesting that in the successful characters or the most successful comedy teams in history, they are out there just a little ahead of us, but as you said, not too far ahead.
If they're too far, we don't get them. We can't relate. But they have to lead us slightly. They have to at least reflect the world that we're living in. And I think for the great ones, you know, there are a lot of teams survived only for a short moment on the cultural stage, and then they disappear. But some of them, the Marx Brothers, the Burns and Allens, the Laurels and Hardys, the ones who survived across time, they reached deeper than just the cultural moment. They got at some crucial aspect of what it meant to be human. We saw a Harpo Marx, and we felt deeply the pain of human existence. We saw it in Lou Costello, or, to get away from teams for a moment, Charlie Chaplin. They developed the characters that were highly sympathetic to many people in the audience.
Mm. A little bit of pain and a little bit of laughter.
That's right. Well, the classic definition of comedy is tragedy plus time. And the time gives you the chance to accept it, but still need some relief from it. And that's where the comedy comes in.
Yeah. Are there other things that you would say are essential to a successful comedy team?
Some level of cooperation. You know, there are very few teams that really got along very well. Laurel and Hardy did. Laurel got paid twice as much, but Hardy didn't mind because Laurel did more than twice as much work and Hardy could go off and play golf. Laurel was always going around, driving around Los Angeles, looking for spots. What can I do as a gig here and a gig there? And because of his great generosity of spirit, when Laurel came up with an idea, I mean, there's a minor film that they make called Swiss Miss, and in it they're carrying a piano across a narrow swaying rope bridge high over a Swiss gorge. They get halfway, and there's a gorilla. Only Stan Laurel could think of that. But a selfish comic would have said, okay, I'm going to let the gorilla play with me, not Laurel. He let the gorilla play with Hardy and Hardy's hat. That was the key to their success, that Laurel saw a good bit and then gave it to Hardy. It's very difficult to slice fame, to slice money, and almost no comedy teams could do it. Abbott and Costello were very jealous of each other. They competed, but they got along because the Abbott character sort of bullied the Costello character. If they liked each other too much, it might have been hard for them to do it. If they hated each other too much, they wouldn't have been able to perform at all. So a kind of conflict model was useful for many comedians.
Yeah.
Look, some comedy teams members couldn't talk to each other off stage or only talked about the act. In vaudeville, it's often misunderstood, but in vaudeville, the so-called straight man got 60% of the salary, and the comic 40%. So immediately there was sort of built-in tension. And as you can imagine, just traveling together and having to perform together and stay together all the time became very, very difficult.
Yeah. I didn't realize how tough a crowd our gang was.
Yeah. Ooh. Oh, yeah. Oh, they were a group of Tough kids. Well, Carl Switzer, Alfalfa, was a well-known brat around Hollywood. Nobody wanted to use him, and they were kids, and they played pranks and Alfalfa, who was beloved by the audience, and they couldn't get away from him, was a mean little kid. He played dirty tricks, and he wanted to be on stage and the center, and a lot of the yeah. art gang people had tough lives.
Yeah.
Not so easy to become successful as a child, which we know now very well, but then wasn't so sure.
Yeah. Well, back to Abbott and Costello, that model that they developed, it had one of the characters has a little edge to him, and we see that again more recently in Belushi and Aykroyd.
That's right. The comedians in teams are always looking for some kind of the nature of their relationship. Belushi's so filled the stage. Aykroyd, I think, had a tough time trying to find just exactly what role to play, because Belushi was literally and figuratively larger than life. He could fill up the whole screen all by himself. Even on Saturday Night Live, the people who started with him said, when this guy was on screen, you stood back because all eyes were on him. Abbott and Costello, on the other hand, I think had a very good model, because they shared it. And while the Costello character was obviously the funny one, the Abbott character was still needed. You needed somebody to set that up. Costello, all by himself, would wander off. A kite flying loose in the sky, the string man was the person holding the string, pulling him back down, making sure mm-hmm. he didn't fly away, get away from the audience. And Abbott, I think, in a quasi-adult way, handled that very well. By the time it got to Cheech and Chong and Belushi and Aykroyd, there were no more adults in the act. They were sort of adolescents together mm-hmm. against the world.
Yeah. You know, recently I was home under the weather last week one day, and I saw a bit of Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure. Boy. You know, another pair of adolescents,
that's right.
literally, and that's how they worked in the movie, figuratively. But there's something so sweet about them.
It's very sweet, and you get this even in all those Dumb and Dumber sorts of films, where you have people who have not matured, and somehow working together as a group, that they get by in life. Isn't this writ larger the premise of Seinfeld, for example? I mean, actually, in the last chapter of Mixed Nuts, what I do is sort of take the arc all the way to the current day and talk about how comedy teams influence contemporary sitcoms. You can see on Friends, for example, the Joey and the Chandler characters, when they had an apartment, had a big poster of Laurel and Hardy in the apartment in many, many episodes as a signal to the audience. In case you missed it, folks, these people are using models, and Michael Richards on Seinfeld for the Kramer character used Shemp Howard as a model. Seinfeld was very enamored of Abbott and Costello, and Jack Benny for that matter, and used these old time routines and timing and ways of developing comedy as models. So this stuff hasn't been lost; it's been transformed. And to really understand, I think, contemporary comedy, it's useful to go back. I wrote the book because I missed them, and I wanted in one place to get down all the jokes and all the routines and all the stories about these folks that I didn't know, and to make sure the heritage was preserved. But it's also very useful as you read through the whole history of the teams. You see what an influence it is on contemporary comedy.
Yeah. Well, you know, when we think of comedy teams today, I think we're likely to think of the ensemble players
exactly.
of television, like Friends and Frasier. But both of those shows, Seinfeld, both of those shows, all three of those shows, no longer in production, have ceased.
No, that's right.
So, and some critics have wondered if the time of the sitcom has passed.
I think, you know, this happened before in history, and I think what it'll need to be is some inventive sitcom, something that breaks the mold in a way we haven't seen comedy done before. It may be also, I'm not sure, this is really cheap sociology, so I'm not sure this is true, but it may be that we're in this era. Remember I said comedy is tragedy plus time? Well, we had a tragedy. Maybe we haven't quite had enough time, and we've moved away from sitcoms for the moment, but they will return. That's a guarantee. Americans love and need comedy, and so in one form or another, it will come out. That need will come out. In fact, they need teams, so in one form or another, the teams will come out. I think producers will look for a way to that American audiences need comedy and will find the venue through which that comedy can be presented.
This is The Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, Lawrence Epstein, author of Mixed Nuts, America's Love Affair with Comedy Teams from Burns and Allen to Belushi and Aykroyd. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join the discussion this afternoon with the telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. We have a listener waiting to talk with us this afternoon in Bourbonus on line one. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon to you. Thank you. Speaking of teams that influence comedy, did you study the Aces from radio?
Sure. Jane Ace and Goody Ace were sort of the Burns and Allen type characters. They started by accident. Jane was standing by when there was some the next people and for the next program didn't show up, so she was dragged onto the air. And Goodman Ace was a brilliant writer, by the way, in addition to being important in radio. So yeah, I listened to hundreds of radio shows, and the Aces are one of those that held up. Jack Benny holds up, Burns and Allen holds up. Not so many, but those three. I'm glad you mentioned them, and I talk about them in the book. But they're a long forgotten group.
Well, I guess she is credited with making radio funny.
That's right. Yeah, and she had Jane Aceisms, they were called.
Yeah, time wounds all heals.
Exactly. Yes, that's right. Now you see, that's an interesting comment. I'm glad you remembered that because it's a funny statement. That a Gracie Allen could never have said. It was too clever for her.
Huh. Mm-hmm.
But Jane Ace was able to come up with these, that Goody Ace wrote, that was able to come up with all these very clever, witty comments that people, you know, you remember them from a while, that people were able to recall and they would pass on at work the next day. So Sherry was very beloved. I don't think she developed the comedic skills of a Gracie Allen, but she could deliver a line very well.
My understanding was that she was naturally ditzy. He wrote her lines. I'm surprised to hear that because I heard that she was just basically like that.
That I wouldn't want to comment on. But I wouldn't want to call someone naturally ditzy. But I will just say that her husband was a brilliant writer and could come up with these lines like almost no other writer of the time.
Ah. Well, thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call. Next, we talk with a listener in Danville. Line two, hi.
Yes, I'm 58, grew up in the 50s, black and white TV, et cetera. I've had a total disgust of TV comedies in recent years. I don't watch any of it. But I've had good luck since 97 making home video stuff. I started with a nephew who was playing basketball at that time, and I was supporting him in that effort, and I would videotape the games and then make dummy commercials to put in the games. What happened was that the kids would go home, and instead of watching the games, they would fast forward through the game to get to the commercials because they thought they were so funny. And I think it's something anybody could do. Just what they're doing is just sort of like Saturday Night Live, poking fun at contemporary stuff like insurance salesmen and car scenes, things like that. Do you have any thought on that?
Well, I think, first of all, it's very creative and very good of you to do it. I mean, I would just like to focus on the impulse for a moment, that the shows and the comedians and the teams that I'm talking about were ones that didn't resort to the sorts of comedy that's done on contemporary television. So that I would invite you, in addition to being creative on your own, to go back and rediscover the incredible heritage of terrific comedy from people you never heard of, or at least I hadn't. I shouldn't say you haven't. But if you're 58, there were people who were now 78 who saw stuff that you didn't see, and some of those didn't survive. You can go back and get some old movies of, say, Wheeler and Woolsey, who were contemporaries of the Marx Brothers, but who never became famous, yet their movies are hilarious. So I would say keep being creative. It sounds wonderful, and I encourage others to do that too. Look to create your own comedy, but supplement it with rediscovering parts of the comedic heritage of the United States that are terrific to suddenly find. It's like searching around in an attic and finding treasures that you didn't even know were there.
Do you agree that the sitcoms that are currently and have been running for 10, 15 years are very predictable, laugh-oriented with canned laughter type stuff where the people have to look a certain way, and everything is so phony? Do you understand what I'm getting at?
I do. Look, I just want to remind you that the comedy is written essentially for a very young crowd. That's what the sponsors want. That's who's writing it. You go and look in a writer's room in a comedy show today, and everybody is very, very young.
Really?
And so they're writing what they know. And sponsors want that because it's what the audiences want. So, I mean, part of what you're saying I understand completely, because that's what drove me to go back and look at these older comedians, because they were so wonderful, and they were the ones I grew up with and I could identify with, and I liked them. And I'll tell you why. I was scared when I began Mixed Nuts. I was frightened to go back because I thought, well, it wouldn't be funny. It was funny when I was young. Why don't I just preserve the memory and just hold it at that? Why go back? But, you know, it's still funny.
Mm-hmm. I have a framed letter from Edgar Bergen. Yeah. He sent to me in 1976 before he died.
Yep.
I was requesting information on how to develop comedy material, and he said he would just take it off of television. That was his suggestion.
Yeah, this was an old tradition among comedians, I'm afraid. They did copy down the work of others quite often.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Let's talk with another listener. Listener in Urbana, line one. Good afternoon.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more about people being able to do their own stuff. I think that's really great what the last caller was doing. You know, in addition to some of the more well-known acts, I've heard of these two guys, Tom and Ray, who, what were they, back in the 50s?
Yeah, Bob and Ray. Yeah,
Bob and Ray. That's right.
Right, but they were wonderful. It's, you know, Bob and Ray are really interesting. They're an unusual comedy team in the sense it's not a laugh a minute type of show. It's very subtle. It's very dry humor, and there are people who listen and don't get that. I've heard people. I've played Bob and Ray for some people, and they say, "Well, that's not funny," but if you listen for a while and you get their characters. The characters themselves are very clever and very smart, and they were very successful and very funny, I thought. I liked them a lot.
Oh, yeah, I love those guys. Actually, yeah. Tom and Ray are those two guys on that car program on public radio. also, another one is this radio station here in town has, the public radio station has, you know, two sides, AM and FM, and it was just last night the FM side had this married couple from the World War II era, 1940s, name of Fibber and Molly.
Yeah, Fibber McGee and Molly.
Yeah.
They were extremely popular at the time. And they, you know, like many comedians, they developed national catchphrases. So people would repeat what Fibber had said the night before, and it enter into their speech. We still do this with television shows. But it's amazing, if you think about it, how long ago... these kinds of programs became part of our lives. And people thought of Fibber McGee and Molly as neighbors, you know?
Yeah, I think you could easily just there's so much. I would say there's so much material out there. You could easily, just if you listen to enough of it, you could make up your own stuff. I think that would be a lot of fun.
I totally agree with you, and it's great. I want to remind you though that the key is listening to the stuff, to really absorbing it and learning it, and then seeing what you can do with it. I think that'd be a great task for anyone.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. It reminds me of a piece of information that you include in Mixed Nuts, and this is back to George Burns. You know, he had that cigar, and he would move his tongue from one side of his lower lip to the other. What a brilliant thing to do.
He was very clever. I'm saying the guy was brilliant. He knew each movement. It was all timing so that the audience was prepared and he was ready and he didn't step on her lines. It's a model. You could film it. You could time it. It was. It's no accident that they were the most famous team in vaudeville and then in radio. They perfected this. You don't just do this. You don't just get some lines and read it. It's like it's why people can't really do the Who's on First routine from Abbott and Costello. They can repeat the words.
Yeah.
But they can't inhabit the characters. They can't get the timing down. You know, Lou Costello's daughter told me that one time she was watching them in Las Vegas, and they got lost in the act. The audience didn't understand this because the act is built on confusion. And she was this little girl. She got so scared for her dad because she knew the act, and she didn't know where this was going. But they found their way out of it. They were so clever and so good. They did this to prevent from being bored. But this also made for a great teamwork because Costello was brilliant at improvisation. Costello was absolutely quick and fast, and Abbott had to listen carefully to keep up. Again, because of listening, he became a better straight man because he knew Costello wasn't just going to deliver a line and he'd give a line back that they had done 10 million times. They had to keep fresh, so Costello would improvise and Abbott would listen carefully and respond to it. Larry Fine's grandson told me that the Three Stooges, at the end of their life, after having performed acts, Lord knows how many times, still rehearsed. They wanted to get the timing because every step had to be perfect. I think comedians who take their craft seriously do this.
Let's talk with another listener. Caller in Champagne, line 3. Hi. Line 3? Let's try again, line 3 one more time, and then we'll try and come back. Let's go to the toll-free line. Listener in Eureka, line 4. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. I'm really enjoying this conversation. I appreciate your study because I think the older comics have had a, as you use the word, great craft that's been lost. I just before I ask my question, how much is your book selling for? It's the name of it is Mixed Nuts, is that right?
Yeah, Mixed Nuts. I think Amazon is like $17, something like that.
Okay. My question is more contemporary, and I'll just have a brief comment. I really get sick of the Letterman comics. He used to be funnier when he did on political stuff, but I think he borders on the sick. But what would be your general comments and anything you would have to say about the process that both Jay Leno or David Letterman use in their monologues?
Well, it's a very good question. They go through. They use a lot of writers. And they try to be fresh, contemporary. Leno essentially turned the show into an all-comedy show. Letterman has a sharper edge to his than Leno does. Leno is softer. But again, I would remind you of the audience that they seek. Even
yeah.
though both of them are older, both in their 50s, the audience that they want for advertisers is very young. So, again, they're hiring the young writers. They're doing comedy that reflects that, but they also have another side to them that I do think is important. That is, they reflect a comedic sensibility applied to politics.
Mm-hmm.
And so many people in politics, rightly or wrongly, take Jon Stewart, David Letterman, Jay Leno very seriously because it sounds odd, but these late-night comics have a great deal of political power.
Mm-hmm.
That is, if Letterman starts mocking you and mocking you and mocking you about a flaw that you have, all of a sudden that's picked up in the wider culture, and you really, the perception is you really do have that flaw.
Are they looking for a demographic in their advertising, what, 18 to 34?
Exactly right. That's what they want. And if you see the breakdown in the ratings, you'll see there's an overall ratings breakdown, but then the second one, the crucial one, is the 18 to 34 age group, and whoever is winning that is doing well. Leno has been winning, by the way, just so you know, and Letterman's been catching up on Monday nights.
Oh, yeah.
So he's closing the gap, but for a long while, Leno has led that race because he occupied the Tonight Show with mm-hmm. Steve Allen, Jack Parr, Johnny Carson.
I think he's been in kind of a classier tradition.
Yeah.
But anyway, I really appreciate your work. I think we need good humor, but I think we need the tradition you're talking about. They're just brilliant. The ones you're talking about. Thank
well,
you.
You know, I really appreciate that comment, and obviously I feel the same way. I went back to these people because I love them so much.
Yeah, you know, you mentioned a moment ago the fact that Leno, Letterman, and Stewart now are taken so seriously. In fact, on one of the Sunday morning network news programs, they actually have, you know, a week in the funnies.
That's right. George Stephanopoulos does
right.
that. And it's because now those shows have become standard stops. The would-be presidential candidates, remember this started with famously with Bill Clinton on Arsenio Hall. Instead of Meet the Press, you go on Larry King. I mean, or the Tonight Show or Letterman, and I guess part of it is healthy because part of it is that it brings in a large number of young people who would otherwise not follow politics, and I do think that. It increases their interest in it. They want to get the jokes, so they have to learn more. I do also obviously subscribe to the potential danger that if this becomes the sole source of learning political mm-hmm. information, we have a problem.
Yeah.
But I'd like to think that it triggers curiosity about it, and then the young people who were not interested in politics, having laughed at this and wondering, well, what's funny about that? Why is the audience laughing? Will then want to get in on the joke.
Yeah. It's also, though, it also cuts another way, and that is for those in politics, for those in business, if they want to put their finger on the pulse.
Absolutely.
What a great way to do it.
That's right. And isn't comedy a terrific way to reach audiences rather than one more public policy speech? It's why candidates hire gag writers, because you want funny bits. There are some politicians who are naturally funny. Think of a model like a Jack Kennedy, and they just have great sense of humor. They do very well with the audiences, with the press, and that humor is such an admired part of a person in America that politicians recognize that they've got to have it.
Let's talk with another listener, caller in Champaign on line one. Good afternoon. Yeah.
Good afternoon. I'm 61, and you were talking to the gentleman who was 58, so I have a question about old movies, and the ones I remember just barely are Ma and Pa Kettle.
Right.
Can you say anything about them? They had wonderful sight gags. And
they did have wonderful sight gags. Ma and Pa Kettle came from radio, of course, and they were part of sort of the rural comedy that was very popular on 1930s, 1940s radio. But the jokes, at least on radio, I think the movies are slightly better, although they were not comedies that lasted over a long period of time, because the jokes were very geared to the lives that people led. So there would be jokes on Ma and Pa Kettle about not having a telephone in the house, because many people in rural listeners at the time did not have telephones. Well, this stuff was very funny to listeners in 1935, but in 1985 it wasn't, and in 2005 it won't be. So Mom and Pa Kettle, a very good example of the kind of comedy that was perfect for an era and perfect for an audience, but didn't reach down deeper to get a sort of comedy that would transcend that and last over time.
Mm. Okay, thanks.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. We have about 5 minutes left in this portion of the program. Our guest this afternoon, Lawrence Epstein, author of Mixed Nuts, America's Love Affair with Comedy Teams from Burns and Allen to Belushi and Aykroyd. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. We've got about 5 minutes left in the program. If you'd like to join us with a question or comment, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Well, this afternoon I started with a little bit of Marvin Hamlisch playing some piano there to introduce Groucho to an adoring crowd at the Carnegie Hall. The Marx Brothers had a huge success, but they were not an overnight success. Tell us about Minnie Marx and her dream for her boys and how it was that they eventually found themselves on stage.
Minnie was the original stage mom. She wanted success. Her brother had been a successful vaudeville comic, and she saw it. If he can do it, my boys can do it, you know. They started out as a singing act, and they were poor singers. One day in Nacogdoches, Texas, they were singing, and the audience was very bored. Someone had some wonderful, exciting news. A mule outside had been kicking a wagon. So the audience left to watch this hilarious mule. And the young Marx Brothers were, like, completely upset by this. The audience came back after the mule had been stopped. They sat back down again, and Groucho looked over the audience. He started making fun of them because he was mad. He was angry at them. But they thought it was part of the act, and they laughed at it. And Groucho looked over at Harpo, and Harpo starts crawling under a rug, and the audience laughs again. So Groucho said, "I'll tell another joke." He makes fun of them again. By accident, the Marx Brothers went from being a singing act to a comedy act. And then Minnie said, "Oh, okay, well, my brother writes comedy. I'll get him to write an act for them." So they began the Marx Brothers were very clever. In vaudeville, they chose different ethnic groups, so that Groucho was originally German, then Jewish, and Chico, and his name was pronounced Chico, was the Italian immigrant, and Harpo originally was the Irish immigrant. Later in films, that transformed, and they developed different kinds of comedy, so that Harpo was the pantomimist, and Chico was the one who gave ethnic comedy, and Groucho, of course, was the one who did the wisecracking guy.
Mm-hmm. The wise guy. Let's talk with one more listener this afternoon before we have to wrap up. In Champaign, line one. Good afternoon.
Hi there. What I'm sorry to hear or see that has developed is the loss of Amos and Andy. They were really nice and very funny, and I guess it's not politically correct to continue with them, but they were very funny.
I tell you, there was an argument even within the black community about whether they were in fact racist or not. But I think just on a simple comedic level, if I can step out of the controversy about them, I agree with you. I think they were hilarious and very clever. The problem was that they were the only, when they started, they were the only black characters, and audiences laughed at them. And a lot of members, especially of the elite black audiences, thought that was inappropriate because there weren't models for young black kids to listen to. But listening now, and I, as you can imagine, I did a lot, they're still funny.
Yeah. There were black comedy teams. Williams and Walker comes to mind.
That's right.
I had never heard of them before.
Yeah. Bert,
go ahead.
But I just want to say Bert Williams was thought by his contemporaries to be the vaudeville performer who was the most talented. If you can imagine this, Bert Williams, who himself was an African American, was forced to perform in blackface. He had to put black cork over his own black skin because that's what audiences wanted. I mean, it was a terrible situation. But Williams, who unfortunately is left. That's one of the reasons I try to write. One of the real goals of Mixed Nuts was to let people know about comedy teams they may never have heard of or mm-hmm. had heard of when they were young and forgotten, and to rediscover those teams and go listen to the albums or watch the movies, and because it's great stuff.
Yeah, yeah. Well, again, just to sum up here, they broke new ground in that their comedy steered clear of stereotypes.
That's right.
Was their desire.
That's what they wanted.
And then also we had people on stage in vaudeville who were at once celebrating immigration and laughing at where America was with that.
Yeah, it helped the immigrants laugh at themselves and laugh at power, so that they could—they didn't feel awkward in America anymore. What great gifts these comedians have given us all!
Yeah, yeah. Well, thank you for writing the book. It's a pleasure to read, and like I said, you know, it made me head right immediately for my collection of of comedy albums that I haven't listened to for a while, and it was a real pleasure. And I think over the holiday season here, if I get a little time off, I think it'll be time to get some DVDs off the shelf, or you know, at the local rental place.
Well, that's exactly what I wanted in writing Mixed Nuts, so I appreciate that.
Lawrence Epstein has been our guest in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. Look for his book, Mixed Nuts, America's Love Affair with Comedy Teams from Burns and Allen to Belushi and Aykroyd. It is published by Public Affairs. 8 minutes before 2 o'clock Central Time, settlement prices should be in from the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Todd Gleason.
Thanks much, Celeste. From the Board of Trade this afternoon, futures in the bean pit, the nearby contract up 13.75, everything up between 12.75 and 14.25 cents in the bean pit today. We'll talk with Kurt Kimmel about that this afternoon at 6 after the hour of 2 o'clock Central Time during the closing market report. The wire services saying that this was some short covering by the funds of about 8,000 to 9,000 contracts in the just offhand, that represents what? Say, if you did it at 10,000 contracts, that's 50 million bushels of beans that they covered today. So we'll have to take a look and see why that happened. They did the same thing last week, except they did short covering on one day and turned around, and then they sold it last week. Now they're buying that back again this week. So there's a lot happening there in the bean pit. Not quite sure why that is, but maybe Kurt can tell us. Let's take a look at what happened at the Board of Trade in the wheat pit at this hour. Futures are settled. December contract, a 289.25 high in the wheat pit, the low at 286, and the soft red winter wheat settled at 286 in Chicago, up 2.75 cents. The March contract, a 302.5 high, low at 297.5, settlement price there $2.99, up 2.5, and the May contract, a 309.5 high, low at 305, settled 305.75. They were up 2.25 for the day. July futures, 316.25 high, low at 311.5, a settlement price at 312.75, up 3 cents. And September futures, 323 the high, the low at 319.5, settlement price down on that low at 319.5, up 2.5 cents still for the day in the September wheat contract. From the corn pit, the nearby December contract, a 197.75 high, low 195.5, settled at 197.25, up near the high for the day, 3.75 higher. The March contract up 3.5 cents, 205.5 the high, the low at 03, settled at $2.04.75, up 3.5. May corn futures, 212.75 high, low at 310.5, settled 212.5, up 3.5. In July, 220.25 the high, the low at 218, settlement price 219.75, they were up 3.25. September contract, 227.75 the high, the low at 225.5, settled at 227.5. They finished the day 3.5 cents higher. And next year's December contract, up 3.5 cents for the day too. 237 the high, the low at 234.5, settled at $2.36.75 for the December 2005 contract. Once again, it was up 3.5 cents. Dece oats for the day, up 3.5 cents, 172 the high, the low at 67, settled at $1.72 even. The March contract, $1.57 the high, the low at 155, settled on that low, up 0.5 cent. From the soy complex, a lot of action there today, about 8,000 to 9,000 contracts covered by the funds today, a short covering rally, and we'll take a look at the numbers. January, 552 the high, the low at 540.5, settled 546.75. They were up 13.75. The March futures of 549.5 high, low at 539.5, settled at 546, up 13 cents. May futures, 12.75 the trade higher today, 553.5 high, low at 44, settled 549 and a quarter in that May contract, up 12 and three quarters. July futures, a 560 high, low at 549 and a half, settled $5.55 and a half cents. They were up 13 and a quarter in the July. The August contract, a 562 high, low at 552, a dime trading range, settled closer to the top side at $5.58 and a half cents, up 13. September futures, 562, the high, the low at 559, settled 559 and a quarter, up 14 and a quarter. And November beans, 572 and a half high, low at 562 and a half, settled 568 and a half. They were up 14 cents. December bean meal for the day, 167, the high, the low at 162, settled at 166, up 550. And the January meal, 165.10, the high, the low at 161.20, settled 164.90. They were up 552. They were up 550 as well, that is. December bean oil, 20.33, the high, the low at $20.03, settled 20.08. They were up 18 cents. And the January oil, up 15 cents, $20.42, the high, the low at $19.97. And a settlement price for the January bean oil at $20.07. Once again, finished 15 cents higher. Now here's Celeste Quinton with the numbers from the Mercantile Exchange.
Thank you, Todd. Prices were higher today for livestock. January feeder cattle, 101.62 and a half the high, $100.70 the low, 101.10 the settlement, that up 52 and a half. March, 98.10 the high, 97.05 the low, 97.72 and a half the settlement, that up 52 and a half. April, 96.85 the high, 95.65 the low, 96.55 the settlement, that up 80. December live cattle, 86.40 the high, 85.15 the low, 86.20 the settlement, that up 70. February live cattle, 87.50 the high, 86.45 the low, 87.45 the settlement, that up 85. December lean hog, 75 even the high, 74.25 the low, finishing at 74.47 and a half, that finishing 27 and a half lower on the day. February lean hog, 72.82 and a half the high, 71.75 the low, 72.17 and a half the settlement, that up 57 and a half. April, 70.90 the high, 70.10 the low, 70.52 and a half the settlement, that up 35. May lean hog, 71 even the high, 70.25 the low, 70.95 the settlement, that up 75. And February bellies, 98.70 the high, 97 even the low, the settlement 98.10, that up 152 and a half. On Wall Street, let's find out what the latest is and far as the Dow, NASDAQ, and S&P 500 is concerned. The latest information that I have, the Dow up 84 points at 10,627. The NASDAQ 16 higher, at 2145. And the S&P 500 up 9 points at 1197.
The Carl Center for Rural Health and Farm Safety is proud to underwrite agricultural programming on WILL. The center helps residents of rural communities with education and training in farm safety. For more information, call 217-383-4606.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's Ask Dr. Science.
That's me.
Remember, he knows more than you do.
That's right.